Theorizing that podcast audiences wanted to listen to two grown men talk about time travel, Nate Bowden and Brian Martin started a show dedicated to Quantum Leap. Together, they explore NBC's revival of the franchise, starring Raymond Lee and Caitlin Bassett, and its connections to the original series. They also examine spin-offs, such as novels and comics, as well as some mirror images in the form of television shows and movies that share creative DNA with the adventures of Sam Beckett and Ben Song. And so Nate and Brian find themselves leaping from topic to topic, striving to make sense of it all and hoping each time that their next episode will be the one that goes viral.
Oh boy, it's a time travel podcast. My name is Nate, and the Rob Liefeld to my John Byrne is Brian Martin.
Yes, you know, that's accurate. Rob Liefeld really respects John Byrne. John Byrne wishes Rob Liefeld would die in a fire. I think that pretty much...
I didn't know of that when I started, when I came up
with... Well, but here's the thing. Byrne hates everyone.
Oh, well, so it is super accurate. Yeah, I don't like people either.
Boy, if you guys are lost by those references, buckle up.
Well, I know that we've had other episodes that touched on this sort of thing, and you seem to have an encyclopedic knowledge of writers and creators and things of that nature. So it wouldn't surprise me if you educated me on a few things tonight.
I feel like I will. It's going to be virtually impossible to avoid. Folks, I don't know if you are fans of things other than Quantum Leap. I really don't know. Maybe Quantum Leap's the only thing you love, and that's okay.
But not tonight.
No, not tonight. This week, it's a big week for fans of Marvel animation, especially fans who were maybe in their early teens or mid-teens back in the early 90s when Fox Kids debuted X-Men the Animated Series in 1993.
I'm glad you put it that way so that people have to do the math to figure out how old we are.
Look, I want to
stress
that.
You know, our teens, somewhere between our teens and 20s.
I asked a question at Trivia Tonight about Star Wars Episode I, The Phantom Menace, which I then observed is turning 25 years old this year, and I was an adult when it came out.
Yeah.
The relentless march of time, folks.
Yeah, seriously.
None of us are exempt, except two of the characters that we're going to talk about this evening.
Oh, good segue. Yeah.
Yeah, there you go. So X-Men the Animated Series is on its way back to your eyeballs and, I don't know, earballs. This week, X-Men 97 debuts on Disney Plus this Wednesday, March 20th, and it is long awaited for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I'll say, myself included, I'm pretty excited about it, taking us back to an era of X-Men that is, I think, generally considered by most fans to be a most quintessential era of X-Men.
Yeah, definitely in our age group, anyhow. When we did our comic book episode last summer or sometime, we talked about comic books in the 90s, and I don't know if I necessarily want to rehash too much of that, but at the same time, it needs to be mentioned that we're talking about Rob Liefeld and Jim Lee, and I mean, that was the book, right?
It was, yeah.
That was the book, and to be honest, I was about neck deep in the Age of Apocalypse. I think I bought every one of those books when they did the big Age of Apocalypse.
Every damn one.
Yeah.
I was a freshman in high school when Age of Apocalypse started, and I had been reading comics comfortably for about 5 years at that point, consistently, and it blew my mind. For those of you who aren't aware, The Age of Apocalypse was a story that happened in the X-Men comics in 1994. It started, it spilled into 1995, and essentially what happened is a character went back in time to kill Magneto, accidentally killed Charles Xavier, and then the next month, every X-Men title was canceled and replaced with another title that took place in an alternate reality governed by the villain Apocalypse, who we will also be talking about in this episode.
Right.
But it was wild, wild shit.
Yeah.
It was great.
It really was.
Just insane.
I mean, some of the books obviously better than others, as I remember, but the thing that I really liked about it, and it's kind of connected to the cartoon because my understanding of the X-Men at that time largely came out of the animated series. And I think that, that was true for a lot of people. So when I dove into the Age of Apocalypse, it was really like, here are all the variations of what I already understand. How did they take that character and twist it just a little bit?
Yeah.
Wolverine had lost a hand. Cyclops was a bad guy, and he had lost another eye, so he was a real Cyclops. You know, I mean,
Cyclops and Wolverine. Wolverine lost the hand, and Cyclops lost the eye when they were fighting each other.
Yeah, in the same battle, exactly. A lot of cool stuff. Oh, and
a lot of really, really cool things.
And somehow Rogue was Magneto's girlfriend because, for whatever reason, her powers wouldn't work on him.
Yes. Yes.
I don't know what he was doing, but, you know. Magnetism.
They had a history in the mainline X book, too. They had kind of been close to one another during a Savage Land arc, Lee's run. But
okay, I didn't know that.
So one of the great things about the X-Men animated series is that it comes out in the early 90s.
Mm-hmm.
The X-Men franchise has extended back to the 60s, but it really wasn't popular until the mid to late 70s when they relaunched the book with an international team that included characters like Storm and Nightcrawler and Colossus and Wolverine.
This was the giant-sized X-Men?
Giant-sized X-Men number one.
Right.
Where they introduced this new team. Chris Claremont took over Uncanny X-Men, the second appearance of this team, as writer. Dave Cockrum was the artist. Dave Cockrum eventually gave way to John Byrne. And Claremont and Byrne produced what I still believe to be is the gold standard of X-Men stories throughout Byrne's run.
I think most people do,
Claremont. Like the Shi'ar. It introduced Dark Phoenix. Days of Future Past happened during that run. Proteus happened during that run. All of these huge landmark stories. And when the X-Men animated series came along, they kind of had no choice but to ape the aesthetic that was keeping the X-Men popular in the 90s. And that was your Rob Liefeld, your Jim Lee, and their fingerprints are all over this animated series.
Right.
However, a lot of the stories that they brought in and adapted, and this goes back to what you were saying about understanding the broad history of the X-Men based on the animated series, came from those deeper storylines during the Byrne and Claremont era. The Phoenix Saga and the Dark Phoenix Saga come into play in the animated series. The Days of Future Past is adapted in the season one finale.
And these are all things that have been adapted in the movies just about everywhere.
Yeah.
All the main stories that you might know about the X-Men, these are the ones that people reach to adapt. I mean, what is it?
Yeah.
The Dark Phoenix Saga has been adapted twice in the movie. In
feature films.
In feature films.
The mortal Jean Grey is no more. I am fire made flesh.
It feels like there's been a lot of X-Men movies, but I don't think there have been enough to warrant two adaptations of the Dark
Phoenix
saga.
Of the same story in the same continuity.
Neither of them did a good job.
Yeah, right.
I would like to point that out.
Right.
The animated series, for what it's worth, does a pretty good job with it.
Yeah.
And that happens in season three.
And this episode is an adaptation too, isn't it?
It actually isn't.
Well,
it feels like it should be, but it's not quite an adaptation. Now, it's taking some
elements at the very least. Okay, yeah.
Of the current comics in the mid-90s, most notably the Legacy Virus.
See, that's what I thought it was an adaptation of, the Legacy Virus storyline.
Yeah, it was an illness that debuted at the end of a mega crossover in 1992 or 93, maybe, called The Executioner's Song. The denouement of that story had basically a canister opening and releasing this virus into the world. Mm. And it plagued the X-Men and the Marvel Universe for about 10 years after that.
Right.
It was a very long-winded, long unresolved storyline. The animated series manages to introduce and resolve the storyline in the span of about 40 minutes. So good on them.
It's more like they mention that this is going to happen.
But they also merge two different X-Men related viruses into one. The idea of the Legacy Virus and the idea of the Techno-Organic Virus, which is the disease that a young Nathan Christopher Summers was infected with, then shunted off into the future and raised to become the freedom fighter Cable.
Yeah.
Who plays a role in this episode. But gosh, before I get too deep in the weeds on all of this X-Men history and everything, I think the biggest things to know are that the X-Men are a team of mutants who are feared and hated by humanity, yet sworn to protect them.
Right. Is there anybody that doesn't know that?
I hope not at this point. But if you're fans of the movies, you may not completely understand who the characters of Bishop and Cable are.
Fair enough.
Both of them debuted between the years 1989 and 1991, really. Cable debuted first in New Mutants, 87. Created by Rob Liefeld.
Right.
Became a huge sensation. This sort of futuristic freedom fighter. I was a sucker for this shit when I was a kid. Absolutely loved Cable. Founded the team X-Force and became this paramilitary X-Men comic.
Right.
Bishop, also a time traveler from the future, came back in time in Uncanny X-Men. Wills Portacio was doing art on that book at the time, and I think John Byrne was doing scripting on
it. This is why I chose those two names. I went back and did my research.
So Bishop is coming back in time in pursuit of a criminal named Trevor Fitzroy. He ends up stranded in the past and becomes a member of the X-Men with foreknowledge of sort of things that will happen in the future. Both of these characters factor into the two episodes of the 90s X-Men series we're going to be talking about tonight. It's a two-parter from season two called Time Fugitives.
Yeah. And pardon me while I pop open this jar of olives.
Crushing some olives tonight.
I got some olives and I got some whiskey and I'm ready.
Yo, they got them filling in it? What kind of fillings are in them olives, man?
Nah, it's just standard olives here, but I am ready to talk X-Men.
Okay.
So I assume you were there for day one of this cartoon, right? You watched it every... The thing is, I kind of went back, did a little internet research to figure out when exactly this was airing. First, the years, but then I was like, okay, well, what was the time slot on this thing?
And it was 11 a.m. Saturdays, I think.
It was all over the place. It was an afternoon show for a while, and I read somewhere that it debuted in primetime.
I don't know about that. So what I will tell you about the X-Men animated series is that the pilot episode premiered as part of a chunk of pilot episodes months and months before the show was really ready to come out. In fact, there were changes made to the pilot episode between the time it originally aired, which I want to say was around Thanksgiving of 92, and the time that the show itself started airing.
Okay.
Which was a few months later, I think, into 93. But there were animation corrections made throughout that season.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Well, I remember it as a Saturday morning cartoon.
Yeah, for a solid three seasons, it was Saturday mornings.
Yeah.
By the time they had enough episodes that they could justify airing it in some afternoons, like I remember the Phoenix Saga and the Dark Phoenix Saga airing in the afternoons sometimes in an animation block.
Right.
In an era that perhaps ran in tandem with the Disney afternoon, or maybe chased it a little bit, because that was a big part of the afternoons on Fox. But
this was a golden age of some animation.
I'm saying these things about afternoon animation and Saturday morning cartoons.
They don't even
just
know.
Don't know anymore.
Yeah.
These things don't exist.
But even in the way of Saturday morning cartoons, this particular era was like chock full. I mean,
gosh, yeah.
There was X-Men. All of these cartoons, I would record them on this VCR thing.
Yeah,
and
yep.
I'd tape them, and I would take them to my local comic book shop, and they had the little VCR TV combo thing up on a comic book shelf, and I provided these tapes to the comic book store. It's like, hey, you know, if you didn't see it, here's this weekend's episode.
Throw that bad boy in.
And they could, yeah, and they could run it. I mean, we're talking about outside of X-Men, this was the height of Batman, the animated series.
God, yes.
The Tick was running then.
The Tick came on, yeah. Spider-Man, the animated
Spider-Man,
series,
and then Superman later.
Yeah,
I mean,
man.
And these were all good cartoons, you know?
It's hard to explain to somebody who wasn't really living through the 1980s what the difference is between good Saturday morning cartoons and bad Saturday morning cartoons is.
Like Dungeons and Dragons or something like that, yeah.
Well, Dungeons and Dragons classifies as a good one for me.
It's a nostalgic one for me.
There are good ones, like Dungeons and Dragons, the real Ghostbusters.
Muppet Babies.
Muppet Babies is a very good one, I
think. Man, I was all about some Muppet Babies.
There's a lot in there, God. I could just throw out names, and they're probably names of cartoons you've blocked from your memory because they're just so bad.
But I mean, The Tick? What about The Tick?
The Tick.
I wish there was a travel Tick episode, because goddamn, that was a good cartoon.
The Tick was required viewing. One of those things we would sit down as a family to watch. Like, my dad would come in and my mom would come in and we'd all sit down and watch The Tick together.
I wasn't that lucky. No, it was...
But
my friends, even my friends that weren't superhero friends, would watch The Tick. We could talk about that at school.
Good. Man, yeah, so good. What I would say the X-Men lacked in polish as far as the animation goes, because some of the animation on the X-Men looks very good, some of it does not.
Right.
As opposed to something like Batman the Animated Series, which pretty much looks great all the time.
Yeah, that's actually something I wanted to mention, which is, in looking back on this, those are the two, right? Those are like A and B, one and two, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
From this era that we're describing. And I've revisited Batman the Animated Series enough that that's pretty fresh in my mind. Whereas this one I was revisiting for the first time in a long, long time. And what I discovered in watching this, the animation is not particularly smooth. There are plenty of areas where, like, Storm's earring is like behind her ear, but not really. Or like the beam that's coming out of their hand isn't coming out of the right place. Or, you know, and all the background characters are constantly moving. There is constant movement on the screen in this show. I watched more than just the episodes that we're covering tonight just to kind of refamiliarize myself, and I enjoyed it. But like, Magneto was in there, and every time he was on screen, he's like shaking his fist and his cape is bouncing. It's like the characters cannot not be moving. And
yes.
The designs are so true to what was going on in the comics, they're largely overcomplicated for animation.
I was actually having a conversation with Paprika's Own, Seed, and Jermon Jackson, Snackin' Jackson, this past weekend.
I'm coming for you, Snackin'.
Specifically about this.
As I eat these olives out of a jar.
That the problem with the X-Men animation has so much to do with the aesthetic that was popular at the time.
Yeah.
So going back to Jim Lee and Rob Liefeld predominantly, and I would bring in Mark Silvestri, who was doing Uncanny X-Men just before Jim Lee, and Will Sportaccio, who was doing Uncanny X-Men at the time the animated series came on. And even extending outwards, Adam and Andy Kubert and guys like that in the 90s.
Oh, I love those guys.
They were all in this like super detailed, relentless cross-hatching, like, just, there was so much ink on the page. And as beautiful as those designs look on the page, and frankly, as beautiful as the designs look for the animated series, they are so complicated that it makes it very, very difficult to animate.
Right.
And I think that that really does have an impact on what the animation looks like as a result.
Yeah, it really
does. I think it looks pretty good despite that. But if the designs had been simpler, and I'm thinking of like Cyclops's one-piece blue suit with no detail on it, with sort of the head.
Like they were in Pride of the X-Men.
Pride of the X-Men designs.
Yeah.
Simple by comparison. Storm, characters like that. Jean Grey's costume, so complicated.
Yeah, it really is. And they do a pretty good job considering. But Batman the Animated Series made a shift at one point and became more simple. So the designs, the yellow oval around his emblem, even those designs seemed a little complicated for animation. And then they went and streamlined it for like the new adventures of Batman or something.
Exactly.
Something
They took the yellow circle away. They revised the look of
everyone.
The two that stick out the most in my head are probably the Joker and the Riddler. The Riddler went from wearing a three-piece suit to basically a body stocking and a bowler cap.
Yeah.
The detail is totally gone. It works, but it's done to help streamline the animation, to make it easier to actually animate.
It really does help. And I remember thinking when they put out those designs, like, oh man, why are they changing it? It was so cool. But looking back now, man, those are so much nicer when actually seen animated.
Looking at it now as an adult with the perspective to think of what it must have been like to actually work on the show. It's like, oof, God, that would have been a nightmare.
Yeah, absolutely.
Did you watch any of the season one episodes in prep?
Yeah, I figured I'd just watch.
Like Night of the Sentinels and Enter
Magneto
and those
ones. I watched the first five of them, and then I watched Days of Future Past because I wanted to see how Bishop was introduced.
Yeah, yeah. I think Time Fugitives animation tends to look overall better.
It did.
Than
yeah.
that first run of episodes.
It really did. It's really kind of strange. You would think it would sort of drop off by the time it was in a season two.
The X-Men animated style remains, for better or worse, pretty consistent until the fifth season, where it very explicitly drops off because
oh, really?
They stopped spending money on it. Fox was like, yeah, we want another 10 episodes, but here's $20. Time Fugitives, part one and part two. They were the 7th and 8th episodes of season two of X-Men, the animated series. They aired in December of 1993 originally. And it's really worth noting that it's 1993. Jim Lee's X-Men number one with Chris Claremont came out in, I want to say, September or October of 91. So this is really 2 years into what is the 90s renaissance of X-Men.
Right.
These designs have become iconic in the 2 years since they debuted, and characters like Bishop and Cable have become entrenched in X-Men lore in a very, very short amount of time. And even characters like Jubilee and Gambit, who were not old characters
right.
when this show debuted. Gambit debuted right around the same time Cable did. And a Jubilee maybe predated him by a year and a half.
Right.
If even.
She kind of replaced Kitty Pryde, as I remember.
She did.
Yeah.
The everyman entry character for people coming to the X-Men for the very first time.
And everybody anyway, wore yellow and blue. Actually, that's
yes,
not true.
Yellow and blue.
That was kind of the uniform, but certain X-Men that were popular enough didn't have to wear the,
didn't have
the yellow and blue.
Gambit didn't have a uniform. In fact, there were episodes where the team goes undercover and everybody's wearing different clothes except Gambit. He's always walking around in this weird
Gambit
hot pink chest armor with these weird boots and this long trench coat.
And these weird gloves.
Gambit.
And his hair popping
cracks
up.
Me
and,
the fuck
yeah,
up.
I loved Gambit, too.
Gambit's so
Gambit
great.
Was one of my favorites.
So, Time Fugitives Part 1, written by Michael Edens, opens with a very, very cool previously on X-Men segment, which most of the episodes did to kind of bring you up to speed.
Previously on X-Men.
And it basically goes back through Season 1's Days of Future Past adaptation, where Bishop came back for mm-hmm. the very first time to prevent the assassination of Robert Kelly at the hands of the Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. Bishop, at the end of that two-parter, returns back to the future, and that's where we pick up with him in Time Fugitives Part 1, but not before a visit to the year 3999, which is a year that just sounds like too much to me.
Yeah, it's a little far, especially considering Spider-Man 2099 and that whole universe that they had.
I want to remind everybody that the current year is 2024.
Yeah.
Okay? 3999 is twice the length yeah. of all of fucking recorded history.
Yeah, 2,000 anyway, years from now. Yeah.
Something that I always think of at the 3999 thing. Do you remember another Ren and Stimpy thing? When they would do the Commander Hook and Cadet Stimpy shorts on Ren and Stimpy that was like where they were
sure.
spacemen in the future?
Sure.
And the intro for that segment was always like, blast off to adventure in the amazing year 400 billion. A year that's so large that it just defies logic. This is absurd.
Right.
But Cable's in the year 999. He's fighting Terminators. Let's just be honest.
Yep.
He's fighting Terminators that are in the employ of Apocalypse. Eternal X-Men villain has lived for thousands of years, I guess, at this point. And suddenly, they're in the middle of this fight, and what Apocalypse refers to as a temporal storm opens up.
Yep.
And it's basically a twister.
Yeah, a
guys.
Tornado.
A twister descends, and it is rewriting history. Kind of like the butterfly effect achieved
yeah.
memo that Ziggy gave us at the end of Quantum Leap Season 2. This tornado is kind of rewriting Cable's reality.
Yeah, and Cable's Alexa knows all about it.
Yes, Cable has an inboard computer that knows everything. And not only that, but has a history of X-Men the Animated Series, because then Cable can just kind of hunker down and watch the episode Time Fugitives Part 1.
Exactly. Was that a comic book thing? Did he talk to a little box like that in the comics?
No, it wasn't really a box. He did have access to a computer called the Professor. in those early 90s kind of books. It was a computer from his own time that he could kind of utilize.
Yeah.
Body slide by one, things like that.
Right, you know, that would, thing, yeah.
But it would talk to him. It would converse with him.
Okay. It really was like he was talking to Amazon Alexa, and she just happens to know what the temporal storm is, why it's happening, who caused it, everything you possibly need to know, this computer knows. Well, okay, it was for kids, and we've got a limited amount of time. We got to throw this out there.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the thing that really impresses me about this, and you may have been getting down this road with your intro, but this is non-linear storytelling.
Yes.
I mean, that's no joke for a kid's cartoon.
That's why I really latched onto this two-parter as a kid.
Yeah.
It's like we are going from $39.99 to $20.55 to $19.93 and bouncing around in these time periods, and we're seeing them from a variety of perspectives over the course of these two-part episodes. And it's very, very cool to me.
Mm-hmm.
As a kid whose experience with things like time travel at this point are, you know, the Back to the Future movies,
sure,
Terminator and Terminator 2. There's not a lot that I have ingested in terms of time travel at this point in my life.
Right. I'm sitting here and I'm watching this intro here, and it seems really, really kind of silly because, like you said, they're twisters, basically a time storm, and these big twisters are sort of sucking people in. And it's weird that if
feels like the timeline should have a more efficient way of correcting itself.
Right? Or like it wouldn't it just blink out of existence is the way I would envision it.
All Apocalypse has to do is go into a building, find the centermost room with no windows, and hunker down until this time storm is over and we're all good, right? That's how tornadoes work.
He also just looked up in the sky and knew that's what it was.
A temporal storm.
A temporal storm. And I'm like, what?
Love that.
How
guy.
Do you just know that?
And he's been around the block. And he's seen some temporal storms in his day.
I suppose. I was in the midst of just saying, well, this is ridiculous. But after I kind of thought about it, I could see the Next Generation Enterprise running into something similar to this, but wouldn't manifest itself as a tornado. And it'd probably be more circled around some kind of gravitational anomaly.
Yeah, it would look like the Nexus.
Yeah, something like that. Where they can recognize
like
that time is affected here or different or changing. So what are you going to do when you have 22 minutes to tell a story and you need to represent that Cable somehow knows that his timeline is being rewritten?
Cable's computer knows it. And the thing that the computer says is that as soon as the time stream has realigned, you and your world will cease to exist. So here's the first thought, and I didn't really have this as a kid because maybe I just lacked perspective. Does Cable's timeline seem like a place that we want to keep going?
Right?
It seems like a fucking shithole.
Yeah.
I would be like, okay, well, let's try again. We find out a little bit later that maybe there's another reason that Cable wants to keep this timeline alive.
Right, but
that's my initial knee jerk. I'm like, this place sucks. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, it's like born out of tragedy.
Let's give it a glam up.
This is a timeline that manifested due to war and disease. You know,
yeah.
It's like maybe Bishop's got a righteous mission here. Yeah, no, I thought the same thing.
Speaking of Bishop's mission, though, Cable discovers that, yes, Bishop's time travel is kind of the cause of this. As we saw in season one of X-Men, Bishop traveled back in time, prevented the assassination of Robert Kelly, comes back to the future to find that, yes, his world of 2055 is different, but Forge, who sent him back to begin with, now has no recollection of the X-Men, and a plague ravaged mutant kind. We've talked about this a little bit with regards to Quantum Leap in terms of things you can change and things you can't change. It's like sometimes traveling back in time and trying to fix things just delays the inevitable, right? Something is going to happen that besets mutant kind, that makes a hellish future almost inevitable. And in this case, it's this plague. So Bishop has to return back in time to try to stop this plague from ever happening.
And this is where you start getting in the weeds with time travel the way you like to discuss, because Forge was not protected by a quantum bubble. So
right.
When Bishop initially changed the past, Forge realizes that his memories and experiences must have changed. But whatever he's remembering, he still remembered sending Bishop back there to do something.
Right.
But to do it assassination? So
right.
Did he think that he sent him back to change the plague the first time?
Sure. Yeah.
How exactly did that happen? And my next question is, did Forge see a tornado before his memory changed? I mean,
stands to reason a temporal storm would have swept through 2055 as well, right?
Right, but I guess he got sucked into the twister.
Yeah, I guess so.
But yeah, I mean, he comes back, Bishop comes back to 2055, and Forge is like, what are you talking about? Nothing's changed. And it's like, well, you were expecting him to come back, though, right? So you knew
right,
that you sent him to do something.
Who are you?
Yeah, I mean...
Did my wife send you?
But yeah, Forge, he's a mutant inventor with a robot leg.
Vietnam vet.
Okay.
Vietnam
I don't know
vet,
much
Native
about
American.
Him.
Forge is a cool character, I think. He is the best mutant inventor there is, really.
Does he have a mutant
just
power?
Yeah, it's invention, man.
Oh, okay. So it's directly
he's
tied
like,
to
he's
his...
like the R. Kelly of mutants. If I can see it, then I can be it. He's
right.
Not the R. Kelly of mutants, although he does have some questionable relationships with women in his life.
Okay, I'll take your word for that. I don't know a whole lot about Forge, to be honest.
Well, Forge existed in the primary timeline of the X-Men comics, but was co-opted here to be the future character that Bishop can engage with because he made the most sense as a guy who could create some sort of time machine, I suppose.
You're right. It works, Napoleon. You don't even know.
Sure. He's the Sam Beckett of X-Men.
There you go. So here in the present day, the X-Men are facing accusations from certain factions of humanity. The Friends of Humanity would be a, let's not sugarcoat it. They're basically a group of white supremacists.
Yep.
Led by Graydon Creed, who, spoilers, is Sabretooth's son. They are behind the engineering and release of this virus that they're trying to pin on mutants.
Yeah.
Bishop comes back and subtlety is not Bishop's thing.
No.
That's right. The problem. He comes in like a Mack truck and the X-Men have to rein him in. One of the things that I really noticed in I always used to joke about. Wasn't even something I was just remembering as being like something I was exaggerating. The show really exaggerates it. Cyclops is such an insufferable dick all the time on this show. When he's talking to Bishop, like, if you want to be part of this team, you better start listening. It's like, Bishop isn't on your fucking team. Like, he's like, I'm not a member of your team.
I like Cyclops.
I do too. I'm a Cyclops apologist, but it's always so funny listening to him grouse
the thing
and
I thought
bitch about people.
Where I thought you were headed with that is that Bishop is wearing an X-Men costume. Like, yeah. It's wearing an X-Men uniform, like, the whole time. Before he even knew who the X-Men were, they just used the design that was out of the comics. So on his hip, he's got a giant X-Men logo, you know? And it was funny to me that he's like, who are the X-Men? You know, it's like, what are you wearing?
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. There's one point in the second part where Cyclops says to Bishop, why don't you fight your battles in your own time, Bishop?
Yeah.
Like that. And
my
comment there was, Cyclops is such an absolute bitch on this show.
Whatever. I liked that line.
He's so funny. He's just always, always complaining.
I don't know. I liked that line. I was like, yeah, man, don't go making trouble for the X-Men. I mean, let's be honest. When he came down on him like that, what was he doing? He was shooting power blast from his fists at a crowd of humans and destroying the street.
That's true. He's not really thinking about the consequence. Like, butterfly effect is not a term that Bishop's ever heard.
If I'm the leader of a team that is attempting to try and mend the chasm between humanity and mutants, and this guy is going to come in wearing our logo and blowing up the street in front of people, yeah, I might be a little upset myself.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm all for Scott.
So, unbeknownst to Graydon Creed and the X-Men, Apocalypse, in disguise, with the Friends of Humanity is behind the release of a virus that will, yeah. I assume, because this is Apocalypse's whole shtick, cull the weak and leave only the strong behind.
Yeah, that costume, his disguise really made me laugh. I don't know why. It was so funny. He was like a little guy, and every once in a while, his eyes would glow red.
Yeah, but just a dweeb, just your garden variety dweeb.
Yeah.
The X-Men, Bishop, eventually descend upon Friends of Humanity headquarters and confront Apocalypse. And Apocalypse has some just incredible lines in this show. As far as like megalomaniacal villain kind of dialogue.
Mutant. I am as far beyond mutants as they are beyond you.
Yeah. You dare to claim dominion over me?
Or I bring the purity of oblivion to you.
I bring the purity of oblivion to your world. Like, holy shit, this guy is serious.
Yeah, you know, as long as you're talking about dialogue, one of the notes that I made, and this pertains to every episode of this show that I watched, everybody has to have some kind of cool line before they use their powers. And Storm is the biggest offender. Every time she goes to use her powers, it's almost like she has to say something.
Right. Like she summon the power of the storm.
Yeah. Let the rain wash away their, you know, whatever it is.
Shakespearean almost.
Yeah, but I was like, is it part of her powers that she has to, like, cast a spell? Does she have to say something out loud?
Hail! Fill the skies with rocks of ice! Lightning! Deliver this place from darkness! Winds rise and the
maybe they never tried not doing that.
Maybe? I don't know.
You know what happens to a toad when it's struck by lightning? The same thing happens to everything else.
Yeah. Want to play with Gambit? Here, take a card.
You know, hey, something funny, though. Rogue, at one point, refers to Graydon Creed as a peckerwood.
I could not
believe they got that onto Fox Kids in the mid-90s.
Yeah, I noticed that, too.
How about that? You put a cute voice, you have her say Peckerwood.
Southern Belle.
Yeah, goes right past the censors, I guess. But the X-Men battle Apocalypse, and the virus is destroyed, and Apocalypse is really pissed off about it. And as the X-Men are leaving Friends of Humanity headquarters, he basically annihilates the X-Men.
Yeah,
and that's where Cable's watching of Time Fugitives Part 1 ends. Okay, so the virus was destroyed, but so were the X-Men. Well, it turns out, and I thought this was a pretty cool twist, that the reason the Time Storm is happening is because the virus has to exist. It has to happen.
Well, the antibodies need to be created.
Right. The virus has to be released. Antibodies need to happen in order to stabilize the mutant genetic code and save Cable's reality. And so Cable is left at the end of this episode, and this is what really was the hook for me. To save my world, I have to help Apocalypse destroy a past one. So Cable has to aid his sworn enemy. I can't tell you. Picture the person you hate the most in this world. Multiply that by a million, and you get somewhere around how Cable feels about Apocalypse.
Sorry, I was just taking a pause counting all the people that I hate.
You're right. It's a great, great twist there, I thought. Cable's mission is not to stop the plague. It's ensuring that the plague happens.
Right.
Wow.
That is pretty cool. And like I said earlier, the fact that this is non-linear, part one starts and ends with a resolution that part two has to change.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty cool, and I think that's pretty heady for TVY7. You know?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it is. If you're a kid in the 90s and you're watching X-Men the Animated Series, chances are pretty good you've never seen anything like this narratively.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Where we're going back in time and we're seeing things from a different perspective. We're seeing the same scenes play out slightly differently as a character goes back and alters them.
Doesn't mean really? You don't get to reuse that animation, though.
No. That's the beauty of this episode. It's telling a really heady story, and it's probably trimming down on that animation budget because they're able to reuse so much of what they do in episode one and episode two.
I tried to watch this with my son, and we watched the first couple of episodes, and then I tried to watch this Time Fugitives, and he leaves the room, comes back, leaves it, you know, whatever. And he's like, didn't we already watch this episode? Like, when the second one comes in.
You don't understand. Get out.
I was like, sorry, kid, you weren't paying attention.
Yeah.
They reuse animation in a creative way.
It's not lazy.
Yeah, it's not lazy. It's kind of cool. It's like a timekeeper.
Yeah.
You recognize these scenes, and it's a timekeeper for what events are expected to happen next. Because they're going to happen a little differently in part two.
Yeah, in part two, several of the scenes play out almost identically to the way they did the first time, except Wolverine's not there. Because Wolverine is taken out of the story about 5-10 minutes in, and that's kind of neat. You know, there's all these little touches that are very, very cool. Part two of Time Fugitives, written by Elliot S. Magan. Does that name mean anything to you?
It does not.
Borderline legendary, I would say.
And I know nothing.
Writer of comic books, novels. He wrote Superman. He wrote Green Lantern. He's written a ton of stuff over the years. He wrote the novelization of maybe The Death of Superman or one of those things.
You know who I discovered that way is Peter David.
Okay, no, it was the novelization of Kingdom Come that he wrote.
Oh, no kidding. Really?
Yes. Yes.
Wow. Seems like Mark Waid could have written that himself.
Yeah, you'd think so. Mark Waid had too many comics to write at the time,
He's a busy guy.
But he also wrote for the Spider-Man animated series, the Batman animated series, and here, X-Men. He also had a couple of unsuccessful bids for Congress.
Think of how history could have been different.
Anyway, I was kind of surprised. I didn't realize that Elliot Magan had written part two of Time Fugitives until this time, because in 93, that name didn't mean anything to me.
It also seems interesting that there would be a second writer.
You wouldn't just get the same guy to write.
Yeah, given that it's
like someone came
story.
In and wrote Time Fugitives part one, and then someone wrote part two from Cable's perspective and just took the original screenplay and said, I'm going to write a lot of red notes on this.
I mean, Michael Piller didn't let somebody else write Best of Both Worlds part two.
That's very true.
So it's a little weird. Huh.
So this episode is focused on Cable coming back to 1993 to stop Bishop's original mission.
Was there any pedigree behind the guy that wrote the first part?
I'm not sure. Other than Michael Edens being a regular writer on X-Men the Animated Series. I do know that.
I didn't mean to derail you. It just was curious enough. That's a body of work.
Well, you know what? There was an episode in, I want to say, the second season of X-Men, the animated series, maybe the third, where Vindicator comes and confronts Wolverine about his past in Weapon X, and they have this whole Canada storyline with Alpha Flight and stuff. You know who wrote that episode?
No.
Len Wein.
Oh, well.
The guy who co-created Wolverine, right?
Yeah, sure. That name I'd recognize. Sure. I mean, we've kind of gotten off track here, but one of the episodes that I did revisit, Magneto had sent Sabretooth in to the mansion, and Wolverine's got this great line about, why do we have to go stomp your enemy, but we got to go easy on mine?
Yeah.
He wouldn't let Wolverine take Sabretooth out of the school.
Right.
Just as he's sending the entire team out to go fight Magneto. And
exactly.
I thought, man, that's really cool.
Yeah.
They weren't pulling punches in this show.
No.
It's a younger audience, but I mean, these are thoughtful things. I felt like
they really went for the fences.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's a swing and a miss. But when it connects, it's like, man, this is operating at a higher level than just about any American cartoon.
I mean, just that one line that I point out.
Yeah.
I mean, it shows a lot of hypocrisy behind the guy that leads the team. Professor X. And
we all know that Wolverine's right. like Sabretooth is the last fucking guy you want in this building.
Yeah, right. Anyway, little aside there, but you were saying.
So before Cable travels back in time, we meet Cable's son, Tyler. Now,
Is this a comic book canonical character?
Yes, Tyler is a canonical character. He grew up to be a villain in the comics. We know Tyler's going to be a complete dick, but here he's a young teen, maybe.
Seems like maybe the tornado should have gotten him.
And it does. Cable's son, Tyler, perishes in the temporal storm. Cable is then like, I got to go back. I got to stop this. And there, we finally understand why Cable's hellish future is something worth fighting for him. Right?
Right.
It's not about this shitty, war-torn New York City. It's not about all the Terminator wannabe robots running around and Apocalypse's ass standing on a building gloating all the time. It's that Cable's got a son.
Yeah.
There's personal stakes here for him. So he goes back in time, immediately intercepts Bishop when he arrives, and they proceed to blow the absolute shit out of a street corner as they fight each other.
Yep.
No concern whatsoever about the implications that anything they do could cause for the future. They're just like, I'm going to blow you the fuck up.
Well, here's the great thing about this cartoon and mutant powers as they exist. Everybody's powers can have as much or as little effect as is necessary.
Yes.
Cyclops can use his optic blast to create a whole tunnel to get underneath a building, just blasting everything away. It can blow the head off a sentinel, but also he could just kind of knock something out of somebody's hand.
Right.
You know?
He can blow up a lock.
That goes for everybody. All of their powers. It's like the blast is only as powerful as necessary for that particular action. I was thinking about the G.I. Joe blue and red lasers.
Yes.
Because they couldn't actually shoot anybody. But these powers are coming out of people's hands and eyeballs and stuff. So it's, hey, sure, he got hit with it and it knocked him down. <You know?
laughs> So as Cable battles Bishop, battles the X-Men, he sees what's going on in our present day, sees the Friends of Humanity on TV, remarks, scum like that, and I'm on their side. There's got to be some other way. Cable is trying to find a way for everyone to get what they need and everyone to come out on top of this.
Right.
And so he slowly starts to take that route. And the cool thing about it is that we are not necessarily privy to his line of thinking. Right. He starts to make decisions and starts to surmise certain things. It's not laid out explicitly for us. Now, for us comic fans, we start to put things together. We start to say, oh, okay, maybe we're going to do this or maybe we're going to do that. But Cable plays things close to the chest for the most part as he kind of starts to piece things together.
Mm-hmm.
Rogue remembers Cable, having met him on Muir Island in season one.
The Wild Man of Borneo.
The Wild Man of Borneo.
The Wild Man of Borneo.
Yeah. Bishop is in front of the crowd there, and the crowd is throwing tomatoes at him. Did you notice this?
I know they were throwing them up at the window, and they've got like that dog man behind the window or whatever.
There is a scene where people are literally fucking throwing tomatoes at Bishop.
I mean, they're
mutants. I could not believe that.
How do you show that you hate a person or a group of people?
Nate, that's how you show you hated a vaudeville act. This is like, it's such a bizarre thing to me. Like,
it's a kid's
mutants
cartoon.
Suck.
What are you gonna do?
Here's a tomato. Boo. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Bishop really bombed at the Apollo.
They throw vegetables and rotten tomatoes at the Penguin in Batman Returns.
Oh, that's true. They
he has
do,
to
don't
use
they?
His umbrella. Like, who comes to the show with tomatoes? Like,
will they let you do that still?
You gotta admit, I played this stinking city like a harp from hell.
I gotta find out if they still let you bring tomatoes into places.
How could they stop you?
Could they bringing stop produce you from in? Bringing I don't produce know. I feel like maybe that's why they're like, no outside food or drink. And I'm like, what if the food's not intended to be used as food? I have no intention of eating these tomatoes, sir.
That's funny. That's really funny.
Cool bit of foreshadowing here as Cable is going through the X-Men roster to find out about them. And he says to the computer, he already knows about Cyclops and Jean Grey.
Right.
but studies the others. Earlier than that, Jean reads his mind and determines that he's more important to her and Cyclops than Cyclops knows. And it's all because in the comics, as in the animated series, presumably, even though we haven't technically seen it yet, watch X-Men 97 on Disney Plus.
This is not a commercial for Disney Plus, but...
No, it's not.
If they want to sponsor us by, you know...
This is generally a commercial for Peacock. But Cable is, of course, Cyclops' son.
Right.
Whisked away into the future and raised in a war-torn world.
And the interesting thing about Cable also is, like we said, this kind of goes over the legacy virus. And is it the... What was the other one? The technovirus?
The techno-organic virus is the one that infected Cable.
Yeah, and caused him to lose his arm. So he has that robotic arm, right?
Right. So the technovirus is still inside him. His arm is the technovirus.
Okay.
And his mutant power, his telekinesis and telepathy are the only things keeping it at bay. If he lost his mutant power, he would become consumed by the technovirus.
Okay. Okay.
Essentially. Which has happened in the comics.
Yeah, okay.
Of course it has.
Leave
no stone unturned in storytelling.
I just knew that he had a robotic arm and it was virus related.
That's it, exactly. So Cable determines that of all the X-Men, Wolverine could be the key to everything. So Cable fights Wolverine and takes him to a hotel room.
Or
which is
HQ.
Something I think is really funny. He's in a seedy pay-by-the-hour hotel, and him and Wolverine are just in there. Wolverine wakes up, and he's, like, tied to a bed in a hotel. It's like, boy, this is really sketch. Like, Wolverine's definitely woken up in this situation before, because he knows way too many attractive Asian women working in the Madripoor underground to not have woken up chained to a bed.
Are you talking over our audience's head again?
Maybe. But just something inherently funny about Cable kidnapping Wolverine and tying him to a bed in a low rent motel.
Yeah, for sure.
Cable asks Wolverine for his help. The X-Men, again in this reality, without Wolverine this time, converge on Friends of Humanity headquarters, go in to confront Graydon Creed and the scientist in there. Cable and Wolverine body slide in, and Cable just starts shooting at the scientist. He knows who that fucking scientist
is.
We know who
up.
It is, right?
How many peoples have dreamed of my end? You are no closer than the Babylonians with their swords and fire sticks.
The cool thing here is in their climactic fight, so many beats happen the same way. Right? So much of the fight happens the same way it did the first time. But this time, when Apocalypse blasts Wolverine into the primary vat of the virus, Cable stops Bishop from saving him, and Wolverine just gets doused with just virus?
Yeah, a virus that becomes deadly when exposed to mutant DNA.
Yes.
Let's pause here a second and talk about this virus, because this has got to be the fastest spreading, shortest incubation period for a virus I've ever seen in my life.
Oh man, it's so quick.
Early in episode one, Jubilee, quote unquote, infects a shop owner. Truth being, of course, that Creed sprayed the virus in there and got the shopkeeper sick. But everybody just assumes, because she was the one standing at the counter when he started to cough and sweat, that she is the one that was the cause of the disease and is the mutant carrying it. And
just
I'm like,
for context, it would have been like, you know, 4 years ago, folks, when COVID was just breaking out. If you yourself caught COVID and you immediately looked at the person next to you and said, you son of a bitch,
you gave me COVID. Yeah, exactly. And it started a riot. This poor girl clearly got him sick immediately. Again, this is a time constraint situation, but I thought that was funny. And then the other thing, obviously, you're going to put this in the perspective of we've gone through a pandemic. You know, you look back at it and you're like, nobody's wearing masks. Wear your masks, people.
Right. Oh, the things we know now. So Wolverine, of course, just like you were saying, Nate, immediately infected. His body gets all those little marks all over it. But what does Wolverine have that no other mutant has?
The mutant healing factor.
His mutant healing factor. So those antibodies we were talking about that needed to be produced via the plague?
Yeah.
Hey, baby. Wolverine can take care of that all by himself, and he does. Cable figures out a way to achieve Bishop's goal and his own by having the plague exist, creating the antibodies needed to save Cable's world, and also stopping Apocalypse from decimating humanity.
What a great resolution. Outside of the fact that it hinges on one of the most popular characters in all of X-Men, Wolverine pretty much is the center of just about everything. But that aside, very cool that they come up with a compromise of Bishop's mission and Cable's mission, and there's somewhere in the middle that they can meet that accomplishes the same thing.
How can we use Wolverine's power in a way that doesn't exclusively benefit Wolverine?
Yeah, I mean...
That's the unpredictable part of this,
now,
right?
Now, isn't like, that also how the legacy virus is cured in the comics?
No. In the comics, what happened is Beast was able to synthesize a cure, but it required somebody to inject themselves with the cure and then initiate their mutant power in order to release it. And because he lost his sister to the legacy virus, Colossus elects to do it.
Oh, and Colossus dies or something.
And Colossus dies as a result.
Yeah, I remember that. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Like I said, outside of the Age of Apocalypse, my main exposure to the X-Men was this cartoon. So maybe I'm just projecting.
That's fair. That's fair.
Colossus, one of my favorite characters.
Yeah, it doesn't get a lot of action on the animated series, but Nightcrawler's always been one of my favorites. He doesn't get a lot of action on this show either.
Yeah, fair. And both of us, Pride of the X-Men, the precursor to this show.
It got all my favorites in there. Kitty, Colossus, Nightcrawler, Dazzler, all of them are in there.
Which was produced by the same person that brought this to Fox Kids.
Yes.
Because she was really trying to get an X-Men show going. And I'm really surprised that that first one didn't get picked up. Pride of the X-Men was a pilot episode of an X-Men series that kind of spins off of Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, if I remember.
Yeah, a little bit. And I think the most prolific way in which Pride of the X-Men impacted Western culture was the X-Men arcade game.
Yes, right.
Which was built around Pride of the X-Men. The roster is the same. The designs are the same.
Yeah.
So they created that arcade game based on...
A huge arcade game, too.
The assumption
super popular.
That Pride of the X-Men was going to get picked up and go to series. Not that I wouldn't have loved to see the designs from the existing X-Men animated series in an arcade game like that, but I love the X-Men.
Yeah, the opening sequence of that show is one of the reasons I like Colossus the most. I mean, that is super cool. Go back and watch it, anybody that's listening. Man, the opening sequence to that series, so good. So good.
This episode ends with the X-Men victorious. Cable bounces back to his time. Bishop goes back to his future to find that nothing's changed. It's just like I left it. It's devastated. Things aren't great there.
Now, speaking of nothing's changed, what is the reason that Apocalypse doesn't grow huge at the end of this resolution and just annihilate everyone?
He's so fucking pissed off. I think he's just so pissed off. You're right, though.
So angry that he can't even bother to kill everyone.
Right. Because really the outcome is the same for him both times, but one time he kills the X-Men and the other one he just leaves.
Yeah, seems like a plot of convenience.
But as Bishop goes back and finds that his future is unchanged, so too does Cable go back. And he's immediately greeted by his son, Tyler, and they embrace. And his future is now unchanged as well. And maybe that's not such a bad thing for old Cable.
For Cable, maybe. But they've got the antibody now. So the virus didn't necessarily need to rage as a pandemic, right?
Right.
So it seems strange that his world would still exist in that same hellish...
Every time Bishop goes back...
Well, I was speaking
he shows
of
back
Cable.
Up. Cable's I know, but every time world. Bishop goes back, it's like, back in the future again. Nothing's changed every single time.
Yeah.
If it's not the pandemic, it's something else. And I think that holds true for Bishop's time. I think it holds true for Cable's time. Sometime the world is just the way it's destined to be. Covered in Terminators.
Kind of sucks for Bishop, I guess.
Maybe not. Bishop is going to be a main cast member in X-Men 97. Maybe he just kind of gets tired of going back and he just comes to the 90s and just says, I'm going to live here.
Well, I'm kind of stuck here anyway.
So great time travel story, especially for a Saturday morning cartoon.
For like, sure, yeah.
Really, really surprisingly solid, inventive, heady, just a lot of fun.
Yeah, it presents an interesting concept, which is a character who knows that their history is being rewritten.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of neat. Typically in these types of stories, and more logically, one would think if history were changed, you'd just immediately be different. You wouldn't be cognizant of the fact that things are changing slowly via tornado.
Yeah, and I think the X-Men as a franchise, whether it's cartoons or comics, have kind of played with that idea. We were talking about the Age of Apocalypse earlier, right? And this was
sure.
The big reality-altering X-Men event in the comics in the mid-90s. When the inception point of that happens and Legion goes back in time and accidentally kills Magneto, all of the X-Men that went back in time to stop him disappear except one person. It's Bishop. And the reason being is that he's already a man removed from time. So when the time stream realigns and the present-day X-Men disappear from the past, Bishop remains in the past. And then he lives another 30 years. And then when we see Bishop again in quote-unquote present-day Age of Apocalypse, he's like 30 years older, but he remembers the world as it used to be.
Yeah, yeah, that's cool.
Cable recognizing that the time stream's realigning, or Bishop recognizing those things. These are two men who live out of time. Maybe they are attuned to it in a way that we just aren't.
Don't think we can get away without just mentioning the theme and the opening credits of this show, right?
God, man, that's an all-timer right there.
Absolutely. I mean, we've already used it on this podcast more than once.
It's
a winner. I mean,
great theme song, great opening sequence. The great thing about the X-Men opening sequence is it tells you more or less everything you need to know about the characters you're about to see.
If you're paying attention, yeah.
Everybody's got a little moment. This is their name. This is what they do.
Right.
Beast reads books and jumps around a lot.
Right.
Gambit throws playing cards. Wolverine likes to be in the jungle and has big claws.
Right,
like Wolverine's got the baddest fucking moment of that whole intro, you know, where it shows him in the jungle. His costume kind of fades in over top of him.
Yeah.
That's great. Great stuff.
The one thing that really kind of bothers me is Gambit's got a great font for his name behind him.
Yeah.
Storms is pretty good. Rogue is good because they all had, I think, comic
they did
fonts prior.
They did have established comic fonts. So, like, Wolverine's is the Wolverine comic font.
Right, and as is Gambit.
The Beast, even the Beast's is, I don't know if it had been used in the comics at that point, but it, I think, became adopted by the comics, and it's pretty elaborate.
And the only one that really, I mean, Storms is a little lame, but let's be honest, Cyclops is basically just using Comic Sans.
Comic Sans.
Yeah. I mean, that's awful. And yeah, I'm just thinking, why you couldn't come up with something cool for Cyclops' font? He and Professor X both, I think, use this weird, like, bubble letters. And then I was watching that in comparison to, like, Gambit having his Gambit logo on there. And I was just
it's just so badass. That's a good observation.
And Gambit's got all those cool lines, too. 5-card stud. Jacks are better to open. Like, why are you saying that?
Oh, man.
But,
Gambit. Right. Love that guy.
I really do. I liked Gambit quite a bit.
X-Men, I think everybody of our generation, whether it was the animated series or it was the comics, everybody's got an affinity for these characters in one way or another.
I think that's fair, probably.
And some of those episodes of the cartoon really merit a rewatch, because what they were trying to do with the animated show, Time Fugitives just happens to be a very good self-contained example of it, was storytelling on a level that was typically reserved for primetime live action.
Yeah, an older audience.
Yeah, it's like this show, much like the Claremont comics that inspired it, respects its audience and respects their ability to think and navigate a more complex narrative than they might be used to seeing otherwise.
I think it was a good suggestion, timely given the fact that this new revival is coming out.
I had no idea. When is that?
You mentioned it earlier, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
The trailer's out for this. That animation actually looks a little more simple.
Yep.
It's kind of a cross between what we saw in this episode and maybe that What If series that's already on Disney Plus. Somewhere in between.
There's this concept that's come up in modern X-Men comics called the Mutant Circuit. And what a mutant circuit is basically two mutants using their powers in tandem to do something neither of them could do on their own. The Fastball Special is the earliest example in comic books of this mutant circuit idea, where Colossus would lift Wolverine up and just fucking hurl him at somebody.
Yeah.
In the trailer for X-Men 97, there's a very interesting mutant circuit that involves Gambit basically riding on Wolverine's back and charging his skeleton with kinetic energy.
Yeah, like, aren't his claws going to explode out of his hands?
Well, that's what I thought. What is the end game here? Is, like, Gambit just going to hop off and Wolverine going to run into somebody and just blow the fuck up?
That's like, what it seems like.
Either way, cool. I mean, Wolverine's come back from worse than that.
If you have Gambit's powers, why do you choose playing cards as the thing you decide to charge and throw?
Because
they're easy
you know
to
this.
Carry and there are 52 of them?
No. You know this because we have seen characters that we love, such as Jen Chu, engage in card play. Playing cards are the objects of rascals, Nate. Narrative rascals are commonly associated with playing cards.
Fair enough.
There's okay. No one more rascally on the X-Men than Gambit. And obviously, no one on Team Quantum Leap quite as rascally as Jen.
The only other thing I'll say about this, I don't know if you caught this, but the showrunner for the revival was fired recently.
Yeah, like yesterday.
With no explanation.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on there. And the guy's already apparently written or overseen the writing of the second season.
And he wrote Moon Knight for Disney Plus.
Yeah.
I mean, he's had his fingers in a lot of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And now he's just gone?
Yeah, very much a developing story. It seems really sketchy to pull him out of the project a week before this highly anticipated thing that he worked on debuts.
Really curious.
Yeah, it is very, very curious.
But other than that, I feel like it looks good. Trailers that have been out, the designs look good, and most of the cast is back, and yeah.
I'm excited to see what they do with our boy Bishop. And Nightcrawler is going to be a main character on this one, too. So I've got those two things to look forward to here.
No Colossus?
No word on Colossus, though. Yeah. I don't know how that's going. But
he'll be in Deadpool, maybe.
Oh, he'll definitely be in Deadpool. At least one version of Colossus will be in Deadpool 3.
I sure hope so.
Folks, thank you for listening to this episode about time travel in X-Men rather than Quantum Leap. Remember to subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast so you never miss an episode, and review the show. Tell all your buddies who love Quantum Leap, time travel, maybe anybody who wishes they could go back and relive that football championship.
Anybody that might be trapped in the past, like the 90s, per se.
If you got an uncle that thinks he could throw a football clean over the mountains, you can get him on this podcast, too.
So are you ready?
Yeah, hold on. I forgot to put in the crystals.
Like, comment, subscribe on our YouTube channel. You can listen there in an audio format. Please do reach out to us at ohboyqlpod@gmail.com with any questions, thoughts, questions such as, who's your favorite X-Men? Or why are you talking about X-Men on this Quantum Leap podcast, Nate and Brian?
Fair. A fair argument.
It's going to be a long haul till the next season of Quantum Leap, guys, and we want to keep you entertained, and we want to give you things to watch and look at in the interim that have something to do with time travel, putting right what once went wrong, those sorts of things. If you've got any ideas of stories, movies, TV shows you'd like us to cover, please do reach out to us. I'll entertain it.
Yeah, exactly. We're going to get pretty creative over the summer, I think. Also, programming note. Anybody that's waiting every Monday morning to hear from us is probably going to be about two every month, I would say, right?
Yeah, I think that's a safe bet.
It's a little easier to get two out each month than it is to do it every week. So we're going to take a little break while Quantum Leap does the same.
Hopefully you'll rediscover some things that you had forgotten about, like maybe Time Fugitives, or maybe you'll find something new to latch onto and check out. Speaking of checking things out, you can find us on social media. I'm at Captain Burns, CaptainBern on Blue Sky, and Brian.Lee.Martin on Instagram and Threads.
And I am at Action Nate on both Blue Sky and Threads.
And folks, again, thanks for listening. I'm Brian.
And I'm Nate.
And we'll be here in the future where nothing's changed.